Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Hello, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Elizabeth Carney. I'm the chair of the Business and Leadership Forum, and here to introduce our moderator for today's program, James Lee. He's a partner at Jackson Hole Group, an adjunct professor at the Global Entrepreneurship Management Graduate Program at University of San Francisco, co-founder of Nomia, and he will introduce our panelists for today. In particular, I want you to know that he first became a member in 1986. He's an Uber member, and we welcome him to the club today. We also invite our audience to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org to learn about the many fine programs that are here at the club. We have several for Business and Leadership Forum coming up on October 15th, From Climate Reality to Project Drawdown. Is this happening to us or for us? This is being given in collaboration with our partners at the Presidio Graduate School and Buckminster Fuller Institute. On October 23rd, we have a program, In Search of a Healthy Workplace, with Googler's Mikael Bakker. He'll be talking about how we can all bring healthy workplaces to our lives. On October 24th, there is a program called Conscious Business, How Leaders Are Embedding Sustainability Principles in Their Organizations. And one more on November 27th, The Transformation and Purpose of Capital, which is a fireside chat with Jeb Emerson and Donna Morton. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our moderator and member for many years, James Lee. James?
Great. Thank you, Elizabeth. It's great to be here, and thank all of you for coming to the Business and Leadership Forum at the Commonwealth Club. We are very privileged to have with us three distinguished panelists today, and what we hope is the first in a series of conversations around tech for good. Tonight, we're going to focus on using data science to build social engagement. How many people here are members of the club? If you can raise your hands. Great. And how many people are here for the first time tonight? Wow. And how many of you work in the tech community? Broadly speaking, wow, that's almost everybody. So how many people use technology here? Okay, the rest of us. So tonight's sold-out event, you know, is really focused on how, you know, we can use the tech tools that are all around us for a broader purpose, for a social good. We're lucky enough to live in an area in the Bay Area where there are a ton of tech companies, a ton of tech startups, but I think using those tools in a values-driven way for a broader social purpose is probably, at least in my mind, more important than getting your dry cleaning faster in Pacific Heights. So how do we collectively use our talent, our resources, our capital, intellectual, social, and financial, in order to move the needle on some of the issues that are really front and center with us today, and certainly as we go into a new election season and think about not just the future of the city, but California and the nation. So we are, as I said, very privileged to have three panelists here with us who are deeply involved in the tech for social good space and have built businesses that are achieving some of those social ends. To my left, we have Aaron Michelson, who is the founder and CEO of Summary. And we encourage all of you to take the Summary Giving Survey, which will generate a profile of your giving preferences, and Erin and her company Summary will make a donation on behalf of everyone here in reflecting their values. To her left, we have Michaela Rabinowitz, who is the California State Director for Measures for Justice. And Measures for Justice is attempting to measure outcomes in the criminal justice system, and to make more transparent the kinds of data that up till now have been pretty hidden. And then to my far left, is Drew Payne, the founder and CEO of Upmetrics, which is taking the after-school space and relating the participation in after-school activities back to achievement in the academic space. So I want to ask each of them just to give us a little bit of a summary and history of their companies, and then I'll ask some questions, and then we'll open up the floor for questions from our sold-out audience. And again, this will be a podcast at a later date, so we're recording it for use on the radio. So, Aaron, why don't you start us off and tell us a little bit about summary and what you're trying to achieve.
Great. Thanks, James. So I'm Aaron Michelson, founder and CEO of Summary. We are a data analytics company that leverages behavioral science to help measure and assess individual values in corporate culture. We do this really in a three-step process. One is the giving profile, which they've been very nice to promote this evening. So it's a five-minute online measurement tool of about 10 questions or so that actually helps you better understand your own giving personality and your preferences. We then take that data and we do data analytics, what we call summaries, and we do it for nonprofits. Usually we work in two main verticals for the nonprofit space. We're working with donors and members of community organizations, as well as large corporations with the CSR units to try to get the employees more involved in volunteer activities through the corporation. We then look at the employees, for instance, to understand what their collective values are so they could better create and promote activities that they're going to engage in and be more fulfilled at work. And then what we do, the final step is called data-driven curation, where we then take and use our prescriptive analytics to actually promote activities specifically at the individual level or the team level or at the larger cohort or membership level.
Great, great, thanks. Michaela, do you want to tell us a little bit about Measures for Justice and what you're trying to achieve?
Sure. So Measures for Justice, we are a seven-year-old national nonprofit. We are based out of Rochester, New York, and working really across the United States with a focus right now in particular in California. And our goal essentially is to measure the implementation and impact of the criminal justice system across the United States. And one of the things that most people don't know when they hear about the criminal justice system, when they hear big statistics about mass incarceration or racial disparities or bail or things like that, is that almost everything that happens in the criminal justice system happens at the local level. It happens at the county level. And there's no centralized mechanism for overseeing how different counties are implementing the same laws. And there's no in many cases, centralized oversight of that information. There's also been a huge underinvestment in the information technology infrastructure for criminal justice agencies because these are public agencies and nobody has wanted to spend the money to create the kind of data systems that they need to provide the kind of analytics that are essential to actually assess, are they working? And if so, what is working? And if not, why are they not working and what can we do better? And so one of the things that you see is that we're in San Francisco County, and someone could be living in San Francisco County and could be accused of a criminal offense and could have a completely different experience going through the criminal justice process from somebody who lives across the water in Alameda County, from someone who lives in Yolo County, in Los Angeles County. And there's no way for us as citizens, for our policymakers in Sacramento, even often for local government, local practitioners, local policymakers to really understand how their justice system is being implemented and whether it's being implemented in alignment with what the policymakers and practitioners would like. And so our goal is actually to do the work that public agencies have really not been funded to do and collect that data, do a series of analytics to measure efficacy, to measure public safety, to measure fairness and equity, and then provide that information back to the public, to the practitioners, and to the policymakers.
Great, great. That's and impressive. Drew, tell us a little bit about Upmetrics and what you're trying to achieve in the education space.
Sure. So I wear two hats up here. One, a family foundation based here in San Francisco. The Payne Family Foundation focuses on education, health, and women's empowerment. And our core focus historically in the education space has been out of school time. So 3 to 6 p.m. and then also the summer learning gap that takes place. So access and equity has always been kind of at the forefront as our family foundation. One of the challenges we started to see was that the larger foundations that were more data driven were moving away from out of school time because they were seeing that as anecdotal and nice to have rather than impact oriented. And so we launched Upmetrics several years ago starting off in out of school time, empowering organizations that are putting the work in, boots on the ground, with frontline technology for the staff. We would help them define impact up front. Is it academic intervention? Is it health? Is it social emotional learning? So we have a services component to our business. We also do frontline technology. And then we leverage and access data for them and create custom analytics for their organizations to drive program design, funding, and quality control for the organization's boots on the ground.
Okay, great. So Aaron, in your work, you know, at Summary, we see a lot of talk about CSR, corporate social responsibility, and employee engagement, trying mm-hmm. to get employees to volunteer. But those decisions now are made by a small group of people, and they're hoping that employees will respond to serving food at the soup kitchen or painting a classroom or whatever else. Mm-hmm. And as I understand it, you know, your survey actually gives real data so that these CSR folks can engage employees where they are and do things that actually reflect the employees' values as well as the company's values. Is that
right? I mean, and what we're seeing is actually two things. One is that either the options are fairly limited because a few people are making them, so they're sort of reflective of their values, what they think are cool to do, but might not be reflective of the overall employee base. Or there's so many, like we do work with some tech corporations where there's so many options that's really hard for the individual to do that their own triage of their own values, right? It's hard to say, like, well, of course I support education and criminal justice and healthcare. It's really hard to sit there and say, but how do I actually, you know, easily put these values into action? And so what we're able to do through our prescriptive analytics is saying, okay, there's 200 pre-approved, if we're talking about one of the large tech firms, nonprofit organizations that employees can volunteer with. But here are the three that are most going to resonate with you based on your value profile that you provided. And so you don't have to go through 200. You could go to three and we feed those to you. And we feel that that's going to give you the best, most fulfilling experience.
So you save time and have a better match and hopefully create a better value, both for the employees, the company, and the nonprofits on the ground who receive either the time or the dollars from those employees.
Yeah, I mean, part of the reason I created Summary is talking to some of the large corporations and in their foundation CSR units, and they're literally leaving millions of dollars on the table because, and for instance, if it's not volunteering, but their employee giving programs where they need their employees to actually allocate the dollars that they've set aside. But the employees are not they're not participating in the programs that they've spent a lot of money, a lot of time to set up, right? Because it's just not resonating with them. And so, you know, I come from a nonprofit background. And for me, that's heartbreaking to hear that millions of dollars are being left on the table. And all we need to do is we're trying to provide it so that employees can more easily engage, right? We're trying to make it as simple as possible and provide the tools. And so it's sort of, again, we kind of look at it in three ways. One, we want people to help them understand their own values. We want them to think of themselves as a philanthropist, which is why we compare them to other philanthropists and celebrity philanthropists and sports stars, and to easily engage. Like, these are the top three we think you're really going to like. So that's our goal.
And Michaela, so in Measures for Justice, you started off in Wisconsin measuring outcomes in 72 counties in Wisconsin, and then were able to scale those learnings to 6 states, and then came here as part of the open data initiative that mm-hmm. Kamala Harris started when she was California Attorney General. And mm-hmm. now you have sort of a 50-state plan to measure things like how many days are spent in pretrial detention based on race and or income, and, you know, how do we actually prosecute, you know, sexual violence crimes or domestic violence crimes at the same rate county by county. And in California, there are 58 counties. So that's a hugely complex job. I mean, how do you do that? I mean, even though all of us recognize that that's important to do, it must be a difficult process.
That's a great question. And I would say, so as you said, Measures for Justice currently has 6 states that are live on our portal. We're on track to have 20 states by the end of 2020. California is by far our most complicated. And there are a couple things that make California uniquely complicated. So one of the things that's really interesting about California and really exciting for those of us working in criminal justice here is the pace at which the criminal justice system is changing in California is unprecedented. And there are new laws that are really fundamentally changing our criminal justice system that are being passed almost every year. There was a new one signed by the governor yesterday. However, California is very decentralized. So our counties have a huge amount of authority to really implement state law as they choose. And that decentralization continues to the technology level. So every county, every public safety agency makes their own decisions about what data are they going to track, how are they going to track it, do they need an electronic data system. Many are still using paper case files, unsurprisingly. And so part of what we need to do and what is our goal is to demonstrate to both the local stakeholders who actually are implementing the justice system and collecting the data is help them understand the value of using technology, using analytics to actually provide that data to us initially, but ultimately to themselves, to their boards of supervisors, to policymakers across the state, so that they are invested in transitioning from the frankly outdated technology they're using to something a little bit more advanced, and so that they see the value of the analytics and of the transparency.
So ultimately, we'll be able to compare and see if Sheriff Joe and Maricopa County is really going to be tougher on crime based on the stop and frisk policy than the person who's the sheriff in the next county over.
And if there's less crime, if you're seeing improved public safety outcomes, if you're seeing improved financial efficacy in terms of the decisions that are being made, if you're seeing more equity in terms of who's being impacted and people's experience with due process across the system.
Okay. And Drew, sort of in the education space, we've been measuring outcomes for decades. We may have too much data, rather than not enough data. But till this point, those have been, you know, outcomes within the out-of-school time space. So how, you know, attendance-based, satisfaction-based, recommendation-based. And we haven't been able to link those, that dosage, how many hours and how many classes, for example, back to academic performance. And whether that's really moving the needle. And I think that the challenge has been to go from, as you said, this idea of anecdata to real data, both so internally that can be used to run better programs, but externally for funders and others to know what works in that space. And how have you been able to link those, that the out-of-school space to the academic space?
Yeah, so I think that starting up front and defining what success is. So in the out-of-school time space, connecting the stakeholders, you have school systems, you have providers of services, whether it's music, art, debate, sports, mentoring, and then you actually have foundations and individual donors that are a part of this ecosystem. And we need to make sure that all of those stakeholders are aligned on analytics up front and then go get that information and connect program engagement and design to these centralized academic outcomes. And I think that getting those folks in the room, the stakeholders aligned, is that first piece of it, and then empowering the organizations that are serving the kids in the community with frontline technology, get rid of the pen and paper, right? So that's one piece that we have to remove, and then give those organizations access to the outcome data that we're all talking about and be able to map it out. And so I think that technology plays a small part of it, but I do think it's stakeholder alignment up front, and then making sure the NGOs, and it's not just in the education space, but most nonprofits aren't staffed with data and data scientists. They can't access the data. There needs to be a full service model for those nonprofits in the education space and outside to help tell the story and connect the dots.
So technology is just a tool, and you actually need a platform and training in order to make some of that technology be successful.
Yeah, and what do you do with the data? Right. And I think in the education space specifically, lots of districts and schools have been burned by that data. And so keeping it private, working with them on a consistent basis is really an important piece of that as well.
Okay, great. So here in the Bay Area, we're very familiar with the startup scene. Everybody's a co-founder of something and a VP of something else. And I'd like to get a little perspective from the three of you on what makes being a tech for good startup different from just being a startup in the technology space. Is there something that's more challenging as you think about, you know, multiple stakeholders and not just shareholders or you know, triple bottom line sorts of returns as opposed to just financial returns? And, you know, what obstacles or roadblocks have you encountered along that journey and how have you overcome those? And anybody can start.
I have a long list of, so it's been a high learning curve, I think, for myself and also my team. I see my head of product out there, Shireen. Capital alignment, right? Especially being in Silicon Valley with lots of venture capital available. The social sector is really tough, right? From a sales cycle perspective, from technology implementation, analytics, how do you define it? How do you work through that data set with those clients of yours? And does it fit to the margins that require J-curve for traditional venture? There's been a lot of venture capital in the social impact space, and it's gotten a lot of press for, you know, probably for good or bad. So I think right there, that capital alignment to get going as a social enterprise, we're a for-profit company. To recruit the talent on the engineering and data science side, we want equity for all of our employees. So we made that decision early. We have access to capital. We're lucky to have that from three family offices. So I'd say that was really important for us to align with capital and expectations and understand the social sector space and what it's going to take to be successful short-term and long-term.
Okay.
I have a little bit along the same lines as your perspective. We're young. We're only a two-year-old organization. And while we were offered funding already, we declined it in order to I continue to bootstrap the company myself. We have 10 people on board, teammates that are also equity-based as well. And I think the key, especially, I think we all have, you know, national organizations. We have part of our team in Austin, part in New York, and part here in San Francisco, but very, very competitive. I mean, we're talking data scientists and engineers, right? You know, information scientists. And for us, it goes back to our core values. I mean, it's exactly the business we're in, right? And it's funny, I sent the values to James earlier today because that's very much the way that we're able to get an amazing team of scientists and engineers on board, because we're actually, as a social impact company, trying to live our core values as closely as possible. And so for us, it's an incredible recruiting tool to really think about that. And the alignment, I mean, that's the space we're working in between the alignment of those who are on the team and the employees and the corporate culture. So it's something that we look at all the time. But going back to the point I made before about not taking funding, I think it was a strategic decision for us as a company. We want to sell our product. We're a for-profit company, and we're able to bring in early revenue from some of the top tech firms right away. So we're going straight to revenue, which we're doing for our employees, right, for our team, so that they can participate and benefit from what we're trying to build. But if you see some of the comments, like earlier this year from the CEO of BlackRock, for instance, who came out and said that social impact is really important. So we're seeing the entire shift change. And what's really interesting is there's so many ways to use the tools that we've built, but to have large companies come to us and say, like, this is the way that we could actually measure the S in ESG, so environmental, social, and governance. Like before, it's very difficult to measure the social part of it, and yet we've been able, through our measurement tools, to actually provide a score. Actually, we have a score where we could score the alignment between the corporate culture and the employee donor base, the employee base of the corporation, and how in alignment the values are. And so investors are coming, you know, big banks now are coming to us to use our tools about whether or not these corporations actually fit within their investment portfolio for social impact investments. So, I mean, for us, we're really seeing it sort of blown open, and being a social impact company, I don't think has hurt us in any way.
Yeah. So, Michaela, I mean, Measures for Justice, here in the Bay Area, we talk a lot about the intersection of the for-profit and the nonprofit world. You know, and my opinion, that those are coming closer and closer together, where for-profits have values and nonprofits have business models. So, but you guys at Measures for Justice, you bring in a couple of other sectors, which is the public sector, government sector, and also the advocacy or the journalistic sector. The founder of your company was a journalist who wrote a book on the topic and then has expanded to include all those parts. So how do you manage that public sector part of the equation?
So that's a great question. And I think one of the things that we see is, you know, the public sector in many ways is so far behind the private sector in their access to technology, in their use of technology, but their customers, who are really us, the voters, have the same kinds of expectations. So we want to know what our governments are doing and what kinds of decisions they're making and how they're making those decisions. And I think in a lot of ways for us, that's advantageous because we can help government answer the kinds of questions that we know they're being asked by their constituents. I think, you know, the question, sort of hearing you guys talk about some of the funding challenges, I think that's in some ways something that we grapple with. We're a nonprofit, but we're foundation funded, grant funded, and so making sure that we are staying true to our vision of what it is we're trying to do, while also doing it in a way that is compelling to foundations that are doing funding, and then also useful for the practitioners and the consumers, of voters, who are ultimately kind of our audiences, I think is a constant balance, making sure that the user experience of the criminal justice practitioners is meaningful and helps them engage and helps them use data, but also is aligned with the kinds of things that the funders think are important, that the research body, that our researchers think are important, and that voters think are important, I think is a variety of different.
Yeah, so you, the three of you represent three different funding models. You've got a bootstrap model. There's a, Upmetrics and Drew, you've been had some family foundation funding, angel type investment, and then Measures for Justice, you start off with a Rockefeller grant, as I understand it, then you know got $1.6 million from Google and $6 million from Chan Zuckerberg initiative. So three different routes to scale, but all evidently very successful. You know, as you know, what are some of the key factors for success and lessons learned as you think back on that funding journey? Like, you know, would you do it differently? Would you do the same thing again?
Who's getting that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we all make mistakes all the time, you know, all the time. And you think, oh boy, you know, if I could have done that differently. But I think one of the biggest things to keep in mind is like, it's never really going to turn out the way you think it's going to turn out, right? To be really open-minded. And while you think, if you're meeting with a funder, you're meeting with a potential client and things like that, you never really know where it's going to go. And so to me, being, you know, a startup founder really has to do with, again, this openness and just being able to accept what comes your way, to, you know, obviously recognize the opportunity, you know, not kick yourself too hard if you miss one. But it, as Drew said before, I mean, the learning curve is so high. And, you know, I don't know, we learn all the time. Every day, actually, and that's actually part of what I love about being a startup founder is I'm innately curious. It's part of my profile. And I just, I love it. Like every day I'm learning something new all the time. And it's exciting. The people you work with are great.
Yeah, so I was not with Measures for Justice during the kind of early push to get funding. But it, given the work I do now and our relationships with our funders, I think that one of the things that I definitely see is that need to balance the different interests that different funders are going to have. So we're grant funded and we're foundation funded, and different foundations fund the work we do because they have different kinds of interests. Some foundations are really interested in public access to data. They're interested in open technology. Some are interested in criminal justice reform. Some are interested in criminal justice reform from a left leaning perspective, and some from a right leaning perspective. And so making sure that we are meeting our obligations to our funders, but also meeting our obligations to our mission is, I think, one of the key tensions. Mm-hmm. And then I think the other thing that is very clear to me is that tech is exciting and it's fancy and we have like these big ideas and we're going to take this information, we're going to put it out there and it's going to be at your fingertips and you can click and do this. But there's also just a lot of grunt work that it takes to get any of it done. There's a lot of meetings that are really boring, and there's a lot of, you know, for us, like looking at paper files and figuring out how are we going to take these pieces of paper and turn them into the kind of thing you would even want to put on a dashboard and click. And so I just think making sure that everybody who's involved in the vision, whether from a funding side or from a staff side, understands that no matter how exciting the vision, the day-to-day often is hard work figuring out how do you get from the idea to the implementation.
Yeah, and I'll piggyback on that. I think that outlining success with your core team up front and recognizing that, you know, there's different chapters to the company with where you're at. Mm-hmm. We started off when we originally connected with a couple people on our team. Now we're up to close to 35. And now we're adding a lot of participants, organizations, contracts are going. It took us a couple years to figure it out, right? So we were really lucky to have flexible capital that understood the space up front. So they knew it would be really choppy and ups and downs, and now we're at a point where we're ready for additional growth capital, which will open up a different set of investors with metrics and success up front that we will be aligned. But it took us a couple years and some brutal, you know, brutal moments to figure it out, and now we're at this stage where, oh, we can go beyond out of school time. We can do mm-hmm. international work, but it took us a high learning curve and staying at it and really, really being passionate, having the core team that really cared about the work and don't be a vendor in this space. Because the moment you're a vendor to the NGOs or the foundations, that's when you lose some of that, that special sauce to get you through the tough days.
So we've talked a lot about transparency and particularly data transparency. And a big debate here and elsewhere is this tension between transparency and data privacy. You see, you know, private information being released, whether it's by Facebook or on U.S. senators. And so while we want to build that transparency, how do you manage that in education or criminal justice or in the corporate world and make sure that the benefits of that transparency outweigh some of the risks? Can you talk a little bit about how you guys see that equation?
So I can start because we grapple with that all the time. You know, I think that most of us who come to the work at Measures for Justice come to it out of a belief that we can make the criminal justice system better. And also an understanding that we cannot do that if we don't know what is going on. And so really a commitment to understanding how the system operates and using that information to improve the system. And at the end of the day, in order to know how something operates, you need data. You need information on those day-to-day, moment-to-moment processes that really are about people's lives. But from our perspective, we're doing this work because we believe we can improve people's lives. And so it feels like a worthwhile trade-off for us, or it feels like an essential trade-off, because if you don't actually know what's going on in people's lives and you can't do anything, or you don't know how our public systems are operating, you can't do anything to make it better. But that said, a lot of the data that we work with is incredibly sensitive. I mean, we are looking at the individual criminal justice records of human beings who are at the courthouse, who are being charged with crimes, who are being processed for those crimes. And so wanting to be respectful of those individuals, of their victims, if there are victims, of the variety of people who are involved in that is a constant tension for us, and making sure that the way we work with the data maximizes those protections, and then the way that we present the information really recognizes the human impact.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else?
Yeah, I'll give a good example, because I think timing of this question is very relevant. So we're working with BRAC in Africa with a women's empowerment group, and their theory of change is that women between 18 and 22 years old, 70,000 of them, if you're involved with mentoring programs with a woman from your community that cares about the work and your livelihood, it will lead to lower pregnancy rates and higher income levels. So we're collecting this information on program engagement data, and then we're pulling outcome data based on their theory of change. Our mission as a company is to connect over time capital to impact. So if we have all this data, number one, we have to take it very, very seriously. Education, health, specifically, it's really critical, and that's part of our value system. But we want to take all of that data. We know where the programs are taking place. We have engagement data. We have impact data. We want to connect your dollars, because 75% of funds, you know, this past year come from individuals, right? It's not corporates. It's not foundations. It's you mm-hmm. in the audience. How do we connect your passion to those types of programs? So if you care about Uganda women's rights for 18 to 22-year-olds, we want your funds to get to that organization that's doing great work. So what we do as an organization is that data is private. It is yours. You have your dashboards. Over time, we want to create a public interface where the organization that's putting the work in can publish this in aggregate form, public interface, and connect money to those organizations. Because right now, that public data for NGOs is primarily financials. And that's not impact. It's financials. So I think we're keeping it very private. We're a partner to our organizations. But over time, we do want to get that data out the right way.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
I think what you said is interesting there about data being kept in the aggregate form. That's something that we look at. We look at data ethics at least twice a year. We have an offsite, and it comes up every time on our agenda, and we spend hours talking about it, something we take very, very seriously as well. We're not talking about credit card data, but we're talking about our values, which are our value systems and a reflection of who we are as individuals. And so part of the aggregate data is we and we don't want to get maybe too in the weeds about data security, but again, about protecting the raw data, right? And so even with our clients, and we are an enterprise software product, even for our clients, they don't receive the raw data. They only receive our summaries, our data analytic reports. And so they don't see the back-end answers. We also have duplicate data systems so that only, even within our own company, only several people actually have access to the raw data. So most of the employees and our teammates don't. So on security measures, we kind of take both the internal view of trying to protect it, obviously, and then externally, where we're out there talking about ways that the data could be used that we haven't foreseen, right? We're so concentrated on building our products and our markets that it's sometimes hard. And so part of this due diligence that we do with ourselves twice a year is ask people in our industries, how do you foresee using this? To again, so that we could build in parameters or mechanisms if we don't want it to be used in a certain way. But I think one of the most important things we do is we actually give power to the individual. I mean, part of when you take the profile is you're giving a 3-page overview of who you are and a link, and that's your link. And so we feel that providing the information to the individual and not just the corporation or not just the nonprofit that hires us is instrumental to making sure that individuals have efficacy. And so, for instance, people are using our tools for recruitment. Obviously, millennials, everybody wants to work for a value-driven company, right? Well, what are the values of a corporation? Well, it's what it says on their webpage, and it's the same 5 words, right? And so this is a way to kind of take your value profile and, again, look at the culture, which we've actually been able to quantify the cultures of the Fortune 500, which we're going to be releasing by the end of the year, and say, like, these are their cultures, and this is the alignment. This is who they say they are based on their public information. This is who they are based on who works for them, their employee base, and how in alignment. So we're not making a judgment about it, of course not. But what we're saying is this is where they say they are. This is who they say they want to be, right? So sort of their vision statement and their actual, the real world values of their employees and how in alignment that is. And we ascribe a score to them. And it's around the values that we all look at: integrity, innovation, agility, some disruption, empathy. So those are the things that we actually score. But for the individual, we give them that data too. So they could say how in alignment they are with the company that they want to work with. Maybe this is a company they could be super successful at. Maybe it's not. You know, maybe they're not going to get the plum assignments because they're not in value alignment. That could be a good thing because you're, it could be a disruptor, and that could be a great thing if you're in a tech company. But maybe it's not. And so again, by providing the data to the individual is how one way that we try to protect it so that they could use it for their own good.
Great. I'm going to ask one more question and then excited to get our audience involved and hear questions they might have for our panel. So I'll invite you to line up over by the microphone if you have a question for one of our panelists or all three. And in the meantime, like, can you all talk about how you see change happening as the result of your work? Is it a top-down sort of exercise where you're going to convince, in a sort of a, to use the startup language, a B2B sort of way, and you're working at the top level, or is it a B2C, or is it a, more of a grassroots movement where it's going to be employee or individual driven? How do you see that?
We want this movement around analytics and impact and defining it and telling your story to be done from the bottom up. So the organizations that are putting the work in. And so the shift that we're looking for, and we're starting to see it, is that if NGO or organizations in the social sector can lock in the data and the analytics and present it effectively, they can drive funding flows. And we're starting to see it with some of our partners. When they control their information, they can work with the foundations and the individuals that are looking to place their money. That's a big shift. And right now, monitoring and evaluation impact has been very top-down, really expensive, consultant-oriented. It's not working. So that's what we want to shift, and we're starting to see it with our organizations using that information to empower themselves, to tell their story, to improve their initiatives and their programs. And that's something that I know our team is really excited about to be a part of it.
So for Measure for Justice, it really started at kind of the mid-level, at the practitioner level. And part of how our organization started was actually our executive director and founder, Amy Bach, was doing research on the implementation of criminal justice processes as a journalist. And what she started with the assumption that there were a bunch of bad people making bad choices. And what she realized through her research was actually there were a bunch of people who didn't have enough information to make the kinds of decisions that they were tasked with making on a daily basis. And so out of that grew her interest in collecting that data, doing the analytics and actually creating these measures of efficacy for the practitioners. And so that's really where it started. How does a police chief, how does a probation chief, how does a prosecutor, how does a public defender make decisions about how to interact with the people who they're interacting with, who are generally accused of crimes in their daily work? And then I think from there, we also think that it's information that the people above them, the policymakers, our legislators, should have access to, as well as the voters, people who are actually voting for a district attorney, voting for a sheriff, voting for the practitioners and policymakers, should have access to that information. So we see it really kind of happening at all levels, but it started really at that practitioner level.
For us, it's really interesting question because we're kind of going through our own shift right now. We're a consumer product, if we will, with individual profiles with a B2B wrap, right? Because we're an enterprise software product, so we're selling to large institutions and organizations. And so our main goal as a company, part of our social values, is really systemic change around personalizing philanthropy. That's really the heart of where it came from. We want to personalize social impact for each individual. And we thought, and this is probably one of those things you learn as a startup founder, we thought that because we're a B2B company, and you know, companies will take it and their employees will take it, and that's where the shift was going to happen. But we realized over time as we get into it and people taking the profile and the feedback that we're giving, that it's actually going to be bottom-up driven. And so we're actually changing our entire marketing. As we speak, we just launched a whole bunch of testing this morning, actually, around to change it from a bottom-up approach and how we could better tap it. And it's from anecdotal evidence, like people writing to us and say, we want to put the profile on our LinkedIn profile. We want people who are recruiting us to know what our values are, you know, beforehand. And that's when we see the power of the individual in this. And for us, it's been a little bit of a shift, but one that we think is exciting.
Great. Well, before I turn it back over to Elizabeth Carney for the question and answer portion of the program, I wanted to remind our audience again, both in person and on the radio, that you can take the Giving Profile survey at the link above Summary's website, and we will get those results back out to you, as well as the link for the podcast. And then invite you to use social media to talk about this topic using the hashtag TechForGood. With the number 4, not the word 4. So
there's slips of paper in the back, too, with this information on it, so you could take it with you and tweet out later as well.
That link is profile.summary.ai/CCC for our listening audience. And on the radio, I would remind us that we're listening to James Lee and his panelist, Aaron Michelson, Drew Payne, and Michaela Rabinowitz, who are with us today on the subject of Tech for Good, using data science to build social engagement.
Hi, my name is Peter Gisella, and about 17 years ago, I got to talk to one of the co-founders of Volunteer Match about an idea that was a bill in the Congress, so it's in the governance civic engagement section, 37 years ago. And it proposed using the registration process of the Selective Service Program to challenge youth, both males and females, between 17 and 18 to think about civic engagement and civic service. And it proposed doing unpaid part-time volunteer work, AmeriCorps-type programs, Peace Corps, or military service. And as a Vietnam-era veteran served in the Air Force rather than get drafted in the Army, I'm familiar with how the Selective Service system works. And I thought with a degree in behavioral science that this would be a very powerful idea to educate each generation of youth. And over the last 37 years, I've encountered apathy and indifference. 2 years ago, Senator McCain got the Congress to agree to fund a 3-year commission to look at ideas like this. And I have provided them with hundreds of pages of information and oral testimony. But since that conversation with the co-founder or Volunteer Match, I have not been able to find a single tech person that's interested in looking at the implications of this from a data perspective of having youth register at 17 and engage in a part-time conversation and then respond yes, no, or maybe on their 18th birthday to some kind of more serious consideration. No mandatory service, just serious consideration. And the other weird thing is as she pointed out to me, I said, well, it probably costs about $25 million to change the Selective Service program to do this, especially with the internet. And she said, with good tech people, you could probably do it for $1 million. But I don't know. But my frustration is this commission's looking at my idea, but I'm the only person articulating it to them. And it would be nice if I could find some people to help organize the implications of such an idea. And I have some documents. My question is, I'm going to request you provide some suggestions at a later date.
So had a product right there. Add it to the roadmap, Shereen.
So it sounds like there might be another startup, Tech for Good startup in there somewhere. But what do you think about that just idea of using, you know, Selective Service data or government data in order to give people access to additional volunteer opportunities in the civic engagement space?
I think it's a great idea. I don't know anything about the kind of where the data lives, but I certainly know that there's a huge amount of public information that doesn't get acted on or doesn't get daylight to it. And so I love the idea of figuring out how to use information that's being collected through just sort of normal business processes and figure out how we can make meaning out of that and make decisions.
And there's lots of groups out there that you can go and network with people like Women in Data Science, you know, information science meetups and all those things that...
I'd send out, you know, 15,000.
We can't hear it on the radio, but that does bring up an interesting challenge in that how do you attract data scientists, you know, business development people, other folks, you know, help you build this team and this movement in a very competitive market for labor where all those people can go work for the Googles and the Facebooks of the world.
Beanbags, free lunch.
Yeah.
That's really important.
Snacks.
I will say just really quickly, I think civic engagement right now, what we're seeing from a trend perspective, it's very real. It's not a surprise. We're seeing it in the K-12 space from foundations and providers that are really trying to understand how to get kids engaged at an even much earlier age around community and giving back. So there's some innovative initiatives I'm happy to talk offline about that we're seeing UNICEF is doing, and they're going deep here in the U.S., leveraging physical fitness tied to civic engagement and giving food away using technology. So it's happening. So the time is right around civic engagement for sure.
I'll echo that. Actually, we test continuously. We test in 36 countries, all six continents, multiple data sets all the time. And we started testing before the 2016 elections and after the elections and saw a huge shift, not in people's values. You know, your values stay the same unless you have sort of life occurrences. You get married, you retire. For the most part, your values don't change, but how you express your values and how you want to articulate them changes. And this kind of goes to what Drew says in terms of more civic activity. And so we saw the differences in our own profile data about how much time people wanted to spend and how they wanted to actually engage through more advocacy efforts and things like that, which was really interesting.
Great. Next question.
Thank you. I have a question for Michaela. I think the information you're gathering is essential to any intelligent prison reform, criminal justice reform, so thank you for that. My question is directed towards sentencing. There are three elements to sentencing: district attorneys who make recommendations, judges who impose it, and legislatures who set parameters. Of those three, which are more susceptible to receiving your data? And have you been able to measure the outcome in either one of those three areas once they do get your data?
So, you know, it's really interesting, but what we have seen is that it varies greatly based on the local political dynamics in a given state or jurisdiction. So, in some of our early testing and some of our earliest states where we went live, we actually had the most interest from district attorneys who, as you point out, are really critical in making decisions about what charges get filed, how they get filed, ultimately if a case ends in a plea versus going to trial. And they are making all those decisions often blind. And so we saw a huge amount of interest from district attorneys in a lot of the analytics that we were providing. In California, that has been a little bit less the case. And I think that that's in part because there is currently, I would say, a little bit of a political movement to reform how prosecution operates and how prosecution gets implemented. And there's a lot of money coming into local district attorneys' races to promote either traditional district attorneys or kind of this new set of progressive district attorneys. And so the kinds of decisions that they're making are much more politicized right now in California than they were even a few years ago. And we saw that here in the Bay Area, where a couple of the local DA races were challenged, and there was a ton of money coming in both locally as well as from national and even international funders. And so that has made some of the district attorneys a little bit more reticent, because it's not just about seeing the information to inform the kinds of decisions that they and their office might make, but it's actually potentially putting information out there that could be used against them in their political campaigns. And so that's definitely something we have to grapple with. I think legislators have a huge amount of interest in this. And in Florida, we actually worked with the Florida state legislature to pass a criminal justice data bill mandating the kinds of data that needs to be collected on and reported on an annual basis by all public safety agencies, to give the legislature the ability to actually make informed decisions. And I think California legislators are very interested in criminal justice data because so much change has happened and there's so little access. But it really has varied based on the political dynamics in a given place.
So that brings up a great point, in that we are all very in favor of democratizing access to the sorts of data that all of you are collecting. But some of the existing stakeholders may be a little bit reluctant to see that data released, because they'll have a yardstick with which to judge them, whether they're district attorneys or educational program providers or companies whose values may or may not align with what their employees want. So that idea of how do you overcome that resistance as you look to scale, or do you just double down on the people who are excited about that? Which is it?
Well, in our space, so when we work with corporations in particular, like, there are some great examples, unfortunately, of misalignment with corporate cultures going on right now. And so from the corporate perspective, you could absolutely trace back to employee engagement, to not only team productivity, but profitability. And so it's now, you know, very much a bottom line driven issue. And these companies are dealing with misalignment. So for us to be able to deliver a tool that gives them insights and then be able to do predictive analytics about what you can do if you want to nudge, as we say, of course, with Dr. Thaler at the University of Chicago, and nudging, if you want to nudge in a certain direction. Now, they have a choice. Like, we're all about information, right? As a corporation, if you think your employee base, if it's misaligned with what your corporate cultures are, you either change your corporate cultures and say, gosh, we're much higher on integrity and lower on empathy or whatever. Like, they could actually use that data. It's super important for them. Or they could change the mix of their employees as well to better align with what they really feel their corporate culture is. And the employees, as I said before, also are making that same determination. And so for us, we don't see it as a bad thing. We see it as a way to address something that is occurring right now in our work environments, and providing both the individuals and the corporations the tool to make better informed decisions.
Yeah, I would say really quickly, earn the trust, right? And then I think two is, what we did early on was find organizations and foundations as clients that could lead the way, because no one really wants to be left behind, right? So if you earn the trust as a partner, you're not a vendor, there'll be mistakes along the way, you fix it, you over-communicate, and then you find organizations that are in the sector around social impact. And if you service them effectively, others will follow, mm-hmm. is what we've learned.
Okay, great. We have another audience question.
Thank you. I have a question that's somewhat philosophical, but hopefully it can relate back to things that you've seen, or actually hopefully not seen in your work, but it'll make sense in a minute. I'm noticing two trends. One is an example of the work that you three are doing in your organizations, which is using technology for an obsession about truth and about figuring out the way things are, and using data and data analytics and data science and all these computer metrics to figure out the way things are, use that to inform decisions for businesses, for nonprofits, for governments, for all those sorts of things. It's about truth, the way things are. On the other hand, in a wider scale, I'm seeing a trend about untruth and about people who don't care about the way things are and care more about the way things feel and you know, just, you know, ideas that might be absolutely rejected by truth and the way things are, but inform more decisions for people and inform more of the way things actually go and the way policies are decided on and implemented and the way businesses make decisions. So I'm wondering if you have any examples from your work and again, hopefully not, but if you have any examples from your work or roadblocks that you've run into with people saying, okay, that looks awesome, but we're going to go in this direction instead because it feels better or because any one reason that kind of goes against your data, your analytics of the actual truth and the way things are.
So I would say for us, I don't know that I've seen cases where people deny what the analytics say or don't believe them. I think the bigger thing that we sometimes encounter is just apathy. That just is how it is, or that's what I'm funded to do, or that's just the way the system operates and I can't control that, or too many different people inform that decision. And so I think people sometimes don't know how to engage with the information or how to use the information to drive their decision making. And that's one of the things we're actually trying to focus on more as we grow and as we're providing more data to more people, is thinking about what is the actual use guidance that we can provide. But I don't think we've seen a disbelief in the information.
We try to focus on how to use the information. So we do a lot of case studies. So even though we're only 2 years old, we published 2 white papers last year. I have a team of our lead scientist, Dr. Helga Wild, is a behavioral scientist, a computer scientist, information scientist, and a cognitive scientist as our core team. And we're always testing the data, as I said before, so that people actually better understand. And we actually very much spend a lot of time couching it in scientific theory. So our profile is based in behavioral science with the Big 5 personality trait and the Moral Foundations questionnaire. And it has a 90% accuracy rating. You know, you might be one of the 10% say like, oh, I'm a nomad, but you don't really feel like a nomad. But it's 90% accuracy. And so when we try to give that information to people, we try to actually help them see how they can use it in ways that are positive for them, right? So if they want to be more engaged, if they want to build more community with like-minded, you know, folks. And so we're always very much, and it's one of our core values, actually, one of our 5 core values is about being actionable. We try not just to have data for data's sake, but to actually give it to individuals in a way where they can actually take action and make a difference in their own lives with it.
So I kept my phone turned off like a good boy, so I wasn't able to look any of it. Michaela, James alluded to some inspiration for your site and app. Was it Cathy O'Neill's book, Weapons of Math Destruction, or do I have it wrong?
No. So our organization actually came out of a book that our founder wrote called Ordinary Injustice, which was where she got a grant and spent several years going across the country and observing how criminal courts were operating. And through that, really realized how much people were flying blind and how differently things were being implemented, even in neighboring jurisdictions. And it sort of led her to focus more on the need to provide data, to use data to drive that decision making.
Amy Bach is her name.
Yes.
The author.
Hi. So I'm curious, because you guys focus a lot on metrics, because metrics are often used in terms of advertisements in ways like nonprofits often spend a lot of money just competing with each other to try to get funding instead of directly using their funds for things on the ground. Or there's metrics that are just used for advertisements or skewing data so it looks like you're doing something by presenting it in a certain way. So I'm curious as to how you use data not just to further your first order goals of, I don't know, like increasing the number of partners you have or being seeming like you'll help these nonprofits or other organizations gain more traction, but also how you're making sure that the capital that you guys are spending in your own companies is actually furthering your higher order goals of making positive social impact, not just on these organizations, but on the people that they affect.
Sure, I'll jump in. So what's great is the model that we built is it's scalable and it's affordable, right? So when you talk about technology and services for this sector, it's usually really expensive custom development work with limited services. Right. So when we do contracts, it's typically on an annual basis or a multi-year basis with our organization, so we can work with them consistently at an affordable rate. So one of our first clients was an organization in New York that focused on providing after-school programs, specifically wrestling for public schools, low-income in New York City. And we were really nervous because the data, when they started to roll it up around their program engagement data tied to some of the outcome metrics that they were interested in, it didn't look good relative to their goals internally and externally. And one of the moments that we were nervous, well, we're going to lose them as a client because the data is not telling the story that they're excited about, they started to make program design tweaks. So they went from 80 school site partners to 45 in year two, and they tightened up the operations. And I think the models that we've created and what does success mean, it's empowering and working with these organizations on a consistent basis. So those types of case studies that if we can scale, we know we're putting our resources in the right way with those types of case studies. So the more of those stories we have for good and bad, in terms of the data and what that data says, we're in it for the long run as a partner, and that's core to what we do.
We're using it as well for actually data, for program creation. So for instance, we're working with a very large museum, a natural history museum, and while it wasn't the donor database, it was the membership team that brought us in to better understand the values of their members. But they actually provided us with the strategic plan and said, these are 3 to 5 strategic goals for the next 5 years. We want to use your data to actually understand, to build out programs in that are going to resonate with the membership base. And so we're seeing it not just for people to donate more or for more members to come to more exhibits, but actually to help formulate and inform community programs and, you know, nighttime programs and educational programs and the actual exhibits are coming to the museum. And so we get excited about that because, again, that's like truly using the data that we envisioned it to be used for. So not certainly just the currency of increasing it sort of on a one-off basis, but making, again, sort of the systemic change in ways that we hope are going to bring more people to the museum. I mean, I think that's a great thing.
Yeah, and really quickly, I think that your question touches on a couple of challenges in the space, is that typically the technology that's in the social sector vertical is geared towards fundraising, right? So they're taking clips of money. Why? Because every nonprofit needs to raise money, but no nonprofit was created because they love to raise money. So I think it's that shift that we all can help push, is that how do you leverage information analytics internally versus externally as well?
I want to go back to data privacy and specifically what's going on in Europe. You probably know that in Europe they've always been tougher than we have here on how data can be used. And now with new legislation, they're really tough about it. And if you want to collect behavioral data or attitudinal data, but then try to connect that to demographics, there's some challenges in doing that. And we've also been finding that some multinational organizations have decided they might as well stick with the tougher European standard rather than have separate standards for separate countries. So it just seems to me that the European trend is going to spread a little bit and make it that much harder to get and to use data. So how do you deal with that?
So in the work that we do, where privacy and confidentiality is obviously a huge issue, as much as I do see a lot of concerns about privacy and concerns about, you know, data breaches and things like that, I also think that the public sector is moving towards increased transparency. I think the voters, I think citizens want more information about how their government is operating and how decisions are being made. And so I think that while you may be right that there is a push towards protecting people's privacy and data, there's also really a push towards government transparency and more information about how the systems that we are paying for are operating and are making decisions. So I think that, you know, what the sort of fight that we are, you know, have to take around how do we get the information, I just think in the long term, there's no way that the public will not demand this kind of information. People are so used to having information at their fingertips, and they deserve to know how their public systems are operating and to have access to that information.
In our space, Sasan? The consent form is huge. So I'd say out of 100 providers that we work with, specifically around service providers for education, close to 100% don't have access to academic data. But then we're checkmarking it when they're looking for fundraising, saying we're an academic intervention organization. So right there, that's screwed up, right? The model is off. If we get consent, parental consent, we can access that data. And I think part of this is an educational process that we're all on with the organizations that we serve. But we really leverage for the K-12 space the consent form, and then we can go pull from district schools, charter, non-charter, directly.
Yeah, we are about 20% of our database actually is European, and we are GDPR compliant. And also it does come back to consent. Nobody has to take the profile. This is something that you want to do. And so it really comes down to individual consent. And they're given their own data.
At this point in the program, I would usually call for one more question, but I get it today. I just wanted to invite each of the panelists to maybe tell us something that you haven't, that you'd like to tell us, or a little summary of what you want us to know here at the Commonwealth Club. We're so happy to have had you, and after this session, we encourage book signings and further discussions with each other, and thank you, panelists.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I think it's a great way to end is how can we all help you to move the discussion sort of for what's the latest shiny object in tech to how can that tech be used for a social good? You guys are doing great work. Your organizations have really made some effective change, but all of us out here, just by being here, want to help in that process. How can we help? What advice do you have for us?
Well, I think we'd like you to take the profile if you like it. There's share buttons on there, for Twitter and Facebook and email. Certainly share it with your family, your friends, your colleagues. If you work in a corporation, again, we're seeing it bubble up from the ground up of people who really like it and they're going to their managers and saying, this is interesting. Let's have our cohort, our colleagues take it. And so, it's erin@summary.ai. So if you have any ideas, I'm happy to talk with each and every one of you.
So I would say that I think those of us who are really interested in both data transparency and criminal justice are really fortunate to be where we are when we are, because in California, so much is happening with the criminal justice system right now. Just the reforms are really nonstop. And also the tech sector is such a player here that people really have an entitlement to information about why things are happening, what's changing, how they can better understand it. And so I think we're kind of seeing this really critical intersection of policy change and a demand for information, and we're trying to help address that need. And so I think what people can do is call your local supervisor, call your city council person, write to your California State Assembly person, and tell them that you are committed to data transparency, that you actually want access to the information on how your public systems are operating and how your dollars are being used. And I think that is really critical to help move this work forward.
Yeah, I would say just continuing to be really proactive. And obviously showing up here is a part of that. I think about my own philanthropic giving, and it's typically tied to friends asking me to donate, right? Or there's something that happened to me personally or my family or a really close friend that was traumatic, and then I double down on that because it really resonates with me. And then the third one is kind of, the fire, disasters, and then you say, hey, we got to support and we got to help that community. How do we break some of those? And I'm a little bit guilty of it, where we're consistently thinking about it and we're proactive with it. Is just more of a discussion that we can continue to have.
Great. Well, we'd like to again thank our three panelists, Erin Michelson from Summary, Drew Payne from Upmetrics, and Michaela Rabinowitz from Measures for Justice for their comments here today discussing Tech for Good, using data science to build social engagement, the first in a series of talks on Tech for Good. We also thank our sold-out audience here at the club, as well as our radio audience. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.